2013, 7 p.m.
Everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the Othello City Council July 6th workshop meeting. Would you all please rise? Ken Johnson will lead us in a short prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Father God, we thank you for this day that you've given us. We thank you for the many blessings that you've bestowed upon this city and the many citizens. We ask that you be with us here tonight in the decision-making, that you guide us with wisdom and knowledge that we could help further the city. For this, we pray in your name.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please be seated. Again, I'd like to welcome you all tonight. I'm going to move to item 1.03 on our agenda, the roll call. Tonight, Angel Garza had informed me he wasn't going to be able to make tonight's meeting. He had some business to attend to, and so at this time, I would entertain a motion to excuse Angel Garza from tonight's council meeting.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second it.
We have a motion made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. In addition to that, I got a telephone call about an hour ago from Mark Snyder. He was just leaving La Crosse, and similar to the last meeting, he will be probably 15 to 20 minutes late, but he will be here. So I would entertain a motion to excuse Mark for the first portion of this meeting tonight.
I'll make that motion.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We'll move to item 1.04, citizen input. Is there any citizen here present tonight who would like to address the Othello City Council? If so, please raise your hand. I'll recognize you. Step to the microphone and your name and address, and you'll have up to 5 minutes to address the council. Is there anyone here tonight who would like to address the Othello City Council? Okay, hearing none. We'll move on to our current business, 2.01, high-speed broadband internet from NOA Net, NOAA Net. And I understand we have a representative here.
Well, good evening.
Evening.
Chris Walker, I'm the telecommunications director with NOAA Net. I see that I have what I wrote on the board, but I did bring copies, if I could pass these around. I've never been more brought one less than I should have. I'm almost certain of that, but luckily, we have an absentee or two. So, hi, Wade. We haven't met yet, but it's been nice talking to you on the phone. Happy 4th of July, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to discuss a trouble that we have ran into in deploying fiber optic services in your community. As you may recall, a few years ago, we had the opportunity to obtain franchise with the city in order for us to build a fiber optic network in the community as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. That project went very well. We built over 1,000 miles in the state of Washington, and a nice, small portion came here to Othello to enable us to connect what are called anchor institutions. And so those were institutions that were targeted by the Recovery and Reinvestment Act that needed broadband services in rural communities. As a broadband fiber optic provider in the state, we are a nonprofit wholesale telecommunications company. And it is our goal and our mission and our initiative to extend fiber optic services in rural, underserved, and unserved areas to the best of our ability. And we do that by either constructing facilities with our own capital, by applying for grants, whether it's their state grants or federally funded grants, and create what's called an open access network in your community, in most communities in the state, in fact. We've had some, the way we build infrastructure, we try to leverage institutions that have the finances to enable us to construct. And so usually those institutions have a better revenue source that enable us to build. And in doing so, we can build extensions or what we call footprint in your community that then lesser financed agencies can leverage because the cost to construct their facilities are reduced by the amount of footprint that we've built in town. The document I've put in front of you is essentially an overview of our most recent situation that we've ran into that is prohibiting us from constructing to the latest state agency that has requested service from us. Our outside plant manager, as well as myself, have worked for years with Terry on different construction methodology in which we would build fiber in your community. And as you go through the document, if you haven't done so already, we ran into a situation building to a couple cellular carriers in the city. And so originally when we put this plan together in front of the two cellular companies, it was very strategic for us because it was another example of giving us an opportunity to build a good amount of footage in town, so a good amount of fiber infrastructure. The more we can deploy, the more opportunity that we can bring to the community. Well, this particular project, we had done a preliminary design, and anytime you do a preliminary design, you put a cost associated with it based on, you know, best knowledge of the area, and put that in front of the two cellular companies, and they accepted that proposal. And this was a great opportunity for us, but it was also a great opportunity for the city because these fiber connections allow these towers to start providing what you know as LTE. So that next generation of cellular service that increases the data on your phones. Most of these LTE carriers now, in order to do that type of service, need some way to offload that wireless infrastructure into a landline or a hard fiber line in order to carry that capacity. So this is a great opportunity for us, as well as Othello. As we put that proposal in front of Terry, we learned that there is a city ordinance that prohibits us from continuing to build fiber on existing aerial infrastructure. Well, we desired to build it regardless, and as you'll see on the, I think it is the fourth page of the document, there is a example of the financial model, that's more like the sixth page, the financial model that was associated with that project. So typically, when you hire a contractor, you can go probably to the next page. Typically, when you hire a contractor, they will bid out the project, and for aerial infrastructure, usually it's a couple dollars a foot to build. And so our design, which was on the previous map, was predominantly aerial on a vista poles, and there was some underground, and that cost was roughly $63,000. It would came in a little bit differently once we went out to the bid process, but you get the idea. Once we re-permitted that project with the city, we were required to go underground in order to adhere to the city ordinances, and the eventual cost came in at $209,000 for underground construction. And there's a number of reasons for that. Obviously, you've got pre-existing roadway, you have to drill underneath, there's water mains, you have to get really below, and it just costs more, and you're on a pretty rocky area, so anytime you drill through rock, it's even more expensive if you're plowing through dirt. So pretty expensive project for us, but it was important for us to do that. Those two cellular companies were providing services throughout the state, and they're all in rural areas, and they're all providing this LTE services to small towns, Dayton, Pomeroy, Republic, you know, all these small towns that need that kind of service because they don't have you know, fiber optic infrastructure going into their homes, and they rarely even have fiber optic infrastructure into their businesses. So having LTE, in our opinion, is pretty important. If you were to continue on to the next page, actually the page thereafter, my apologies. We get into the overall concern that we're most interested in at the moment, but it really feeds to the overall need of any company like ours, and that is a set of ordinances developed by the city that promote fiber optic deployment in your community. And typically, when you have a forced underground model, that the finances just don't work. And our most recent example is the state agency here in town, 1045 East Main Street. It's the Department of Agriculture. They want a fiber optic connection into their office, much like many state agencies do. We originally put an aerial route together, as shown in the second page map, and it will roughly cost us $21,000 to build. But we do know that that is not allowed with current city ordinances. So there is an underground Route B option, which we've also designed, of which Terry has in front of him. But it's $101,000. And if you know anything about state agencies, probably a lot like city agencies, budgets are limited. And so that size of a project is not achievable for them or for us. And this is really, I want to concentrate on this because this is our immediate need, but it really is a good representation of what the difference is for an agency like or a company like ours to build in one community over another. If we have another community, Community B, and they have city ordinances that promote utilities attaching to aerial infrastructure, we can do it cost effectively, thereby increasing the amount of exposure, the amount of fiber optic footprint that we can do in the community. If we're required to build underground, those opportunities decrease. And so it's a challenge. And so I spent some time with Wade on the phone, and I pleaded my case to Wade, and Wade was very concerned, and he recommended that I come and spend some time with the council members and at a workshop and discuss what the options are to alleviate that policy, either simply for this particular project, but in my mind, more importantly, for the overall community. So with that, I'll pause because I think I probably talked more than you expected. Questions?
So. Do you, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Chris Walker. No
problem. Chris, yeah. Chris, so when you bring fiber into a community, is that really the end of your role and then the line is actually maintained and or the transmissions are, and the service is sold? Or are you guys just the installer? Or where is NOA? Where is NOA in all of that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Mm-hmm. We are wholesale. So because we're owned by the public utility districts of the state of Washington, we're limited to the same authorities that they have. So we can't sell directly to an end user a broadband service, so Ethernet, Sonnet, various internet-type technologies. We can't sell those directly. However, the infrastructure itself and all the equipment on the ends, or even in the middle, is all owned and operated by our entity. Mm-hmm. So we operate it, we maintain it, we either do it through our own engineering organization or we outsource it, or a combination of both. We typically will outsource most of our installation, specifically fiber, and then our engineers will do all the electronics installation and so forth. Really the only third party is that retail transaction between the consumer of the broadband product and our network. So.
And there's a middleman in there.
They're middleman, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think maybe I want to ask Travis a question, if I could. That's Travis is our community development director.
Okay.
And county city planner.
Now?
Right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then just in the interim, and then we'll come back to Chris. So, Travis, the city has this ordinance in place. And where everything is underground. And you and I talked about this morning a little bit. What, do you have any kind of recommendation?
You know, I had a chance to take a look at this afternoon after our discussion, and it looks like clearly there are a couple sections which trigger the, require it to be installed underground. However, at the end of that section of our code, there is a section for variances. And essentially what it says is the city council may grant a variance if you find certain things. One of those is that it's generally the The variance is in the interests of the general health, welfare, and safety of the city of Othello and its residents. So there's kind of that hanging out there, and then there's several conditions that have to exist. A couple of these could be found, but one of the questions that I had, and that is, you know, where's the connection between the general health, safety, and welfare? I think if they could draw that connection and conclusion, I would say that a variance is something that you seem to have contemplated when you adopted this ordinance at the time. So I have maybe a couple questions for Chris, which may affect that conversation. But mitigation would be another way to get at that. So if we could find another way for the city to get something that addresses the health and safety and welfare of the citizens, I don't know. I don't know the Department of Agriculture well enough. Maybe clearly just serving the Department of Agriculture clearly has safety implications for the community. I don't know. I would need to have that conversation with Chris. But one of my first questions, if you don't mind me asking you, Chris, would be of the budget. So let's say we were talking about just strictly the aerial numbers of 22,000. How much of that is coming from the Department of Ecology versus grant or other kind of funding?
That particular part would be due to the direct sale to the Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
Technically, it's to the retail service provider, but then subsequently bills the Department of Agriculture. But yes.
Okay.
How many feet are we talking about?
How many feet?
Yeah.
Oh, I would have to put the yardstick to it, and I think you can tell from the map it's less than about 3 city blocks.
I estimated it was about
500. It won't be. It's on that page. The very specific route itself is the last page. This is the cell tower project right there. That was all underground from approximately here. So go to the last page, Wade, if you could please.
This is the last. That is the last.
Well, if you look at the corrected version I sent you, it's down here, it's this red line, or this blue line here. Last page, you can print out will have that.
Okay. And actually, if you...
Great. Does that work well?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. A little blurry, but proposed Route 3B. Is blue. So you've got about 3 city blocks, that's probably 500 feet, versus this red line, which would have been the underground proposal. And these, you know, these are existing poles. There's no captures on those poles.
So is that an alleyway or is it a street?
It's an alleyway.
So we're talking about putting fiber optics on a pole line. It's owned by Vista. And what's the Vista's feelings on that?
It's right there.
We prefer you on the record.
We have no objection to it. I mean, we, you know, by the FCC and the WUTC, Utility Transportation Commission, you know, they require us to allow attachments for communication. So they meet. We always require them to meet our specifications, make sure there's room on the pole, and if there's not room, they would, you know, they pay for us to extend the height of the pole.
So if I'm looking at this map and I'm getting an understanding of it, this is all of the USBR East Columbia Basin Irrigation District area that we're talking about, and all of that is, I mean, that's like three city blocks worth of land that's not accessible except for their equipment and stuff like that. So and it's on an alleyway which is utilized by them, but I don't think it's utilized by anybody in the city for getting from one place to another in that area. So yeah, I mean, I've never cut through there. It's just people that work at that facility that are utilizing that that driveway, so to speak. It's not really an alley, it's a driveway. And we're talking about running fiber optics on the pole line?
We are. What I would like, that when you get done with Ian, I'd like for Terry to come up and talk about some of the drawbacks for doing this. I understand what both these gentlemen are saying, but there was a reason why this ordinance was passed in the first place.
Sure. And I can understand that if it's crossing a main intersection and you need the height levels and things like that are required and stuff, that's very important. But we're talking about going down an alleyway that's not utilized by anything but the individuals that actually work there and
got it.
And it's not crossing over any major intersections or anything.
There's goodness in doing that as well, but what I want you to understand from Terry is that if you were to go with that goodness, then you also have to accept some of the side effects of that. And so Terry's going to show you. So, Chris made a very good presentation. I understand what he's saying. And Ian, he was nice enough to show up and talk about Vista's role in it, but I would like to just show you what, just so council's fully informed on what the reason the previous council passed this. If you let Terry just show a few pictures and talk about, they wouldn't have to, the pictures actually speak for themselves. And if we're willing to accept that, then that's fine. It's your decision. Staff is neutral either way for the most part. We just want to make sure that you guys fully understand what went on before.
Okay, well, we understand something a little bit better right now.
Exactly.
That it's in an area that's not actually utilized. It's not on a main street. It's in an alleyway.
Sure.
So we understand that. Okay, so that goes along with the decision-making process as well.
Yes.
So Terry can go ahead and tell us what he thinks.
Good evening, Council and Mayor.
Good evening.
We as staff or public works director for the city of Othello, we understand the concerns and the situation that NOAA's in, and they board several lines through town, and they've had to bore underneath them, and I believe they bored over to the T-Mobile run over there to the tower and did some work underground. My position is I have to follow standards and ordinances that are set aside and put out by council. We understand that it costs money. We also understand that the alley that they're working at is an easement for the city, because we have a main sewer line that's in that alley. So we do use the jet truck in that alley. The garbage trucks run that alley. They run all our alleys. But I want to show, I want to kind of refresh council's memory here just a little bit. A couple years back, I believe everybody that's in the city kind of was aware of this, but down here on Shady Lane, we had a utility across down there, and we had a truck get down the wrong street going south and hook that. And I say hook it. He was still pulling gears by the time he hit the second block, and when he did, from 7th Avenue to Shady Lane, Ian probably knows, there was every pole in that, back in that, what would be a utility easement, and you can't hardly get to, you can't hardly access it. Poles were leaned over, poles were pulled down, and one of the houses that, one of the poles was broke off, come through the bedroom, and the man happens to be handicapped where he can't hear. The pole came right to the bedroom. From a truck that went down the street. And this is from some of the stuff that hangs low. It was a chore. Vista did really well, blocked the road off. It was something you really don't want to have happen again. But I took some photos here for a minute. Okay. So this is some pictures I've taken and just one location. I didn't spend time running all over town, but this is a pole here that obviously has got phone, cable, fiber, whatever's on this pole. This is just in one alley, and you can see it kind of hangs down, and the connections are loose. Here again, kind of wrapped around the pole, a junction box there. There's a box hanging off the top. Here's a box that's open to the weather, and excess cable wrapped around it. Here again, some of them are actually cut and hanging down. Here's some that are, these two that are hanging down right here, you can actually grab these with your hand, standing on the ground. This extra bundle here on the pole is actually just wrapped up, and I don't know if it's for future or it's been cut back or what's going on there. Here's some more. here's a bundle that's just wrapped up, hanging there for future. Here's one hanging down here that's been gone somewhere, but nobody chased it back to unscrew that. You can see they hang down quite a ways on this run. Here's some more that cross the alley. Now, these are pretty low. Garbage trucks miss them, but they are low.
Most of the time.
Now, this is a conversation piece right here that I want council to look at. This pole right here was replaced by a Vista on the right. The pole on the left is the old pole that they took their utilities off. This has been an ongoing problem in the city with basically with the utilities. The people that are the last people on the pole, correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, are the people that once they transfer their stuff to that pole, they're supposed to remove that pole. This pole here that's got the top cut off on it, I'll spend hours calling to get this pole removed. And we did this on Main Street, and Big Ben and Avista both agreed that it's tough to get them guys to move their poles once they're done. That's the agreement. But we set out here in a world where we were doing Main Street, and we couldn't for 6 months get a pole moved in the middle of the sidewalk in order to pour that ADA. And we have it all over town. So this is an ongoing problem, transferring the utilities over and the last guy pulling this pole. You can see that this pole is pretty well tied up here because it's leaning to the north. It's got a lot hanging on it. Here's the down First Street. Here, this is down by CenturyLink in the alley, and from this weatherhead on the right, you can actually touch these wires right here. They come right across and they go up to that other pole. And then they droop down pretty well. They run right alongside the poles in the alley. They don't cross. Some of them cross the alley. But this is what you see, what we try to get away from. What we're trying to do is trying to go underground to clean things up and make it a little better for the future. This one here, this is a topic of conversation. I had two of my other staff with me. This pole right here is new, and it goes across here to McCain's, and this is new. This was a fiber run going, I believe, out to SVZ. This was talked about being bored. They bored all the way up here. Staff went home for the evening, came back, there's a pole set here, and the fiber runs down here. They were going to bore underneath this. That's all I have. Any questions?
So, our existing ordinance that is in place, which I probably should have read before I came into the meeting tonight, so I'm going to have to rely upon staff. What is it talk about? New construction?
New installation.
New installation. Okay. What about our new construction? So any new subdivisions, new commercial areas, those are all required power and all utilities are underground in those?
Well, we're working, all of the utilities are underground, and we're also working, and I think we talked to Chris on the phone with Wade about moving forward with some of the new subdivisions and adding that provision in there for fiber underground.
Mm-hmm. So would that be part of what we want to include that in our comprehensive plan and our subdivision ordinances, Travis?
So Terry does have it right. It's actually pretty clear. It's in 1456.030. And it says if you are removing or replacing up to 500 feet, that's kind of the first trigger. And this would be more than 500 feet. It also says, like in the case of new development, if you are extending facilities where they don't currently exist, they need to be undergrounded. So it is pretty clear that new development would require it, unless they can meet these certain criteria like disproportionate benefit to cost and where there are other particular reasons where it isn't warranted to be underground, or there's a physical reason why it can't be undergrounded. I'm not sure what that, why that would be, but maybe high groundwater and electrical lines or something like that, there might be some reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is if there's undergrounding is required and there's insufficient growth pattern. So in other words, if it's the one house at the end of a long road, that might justify, because if there are no other properties that will be served by that line, it might be undergrowth. Like in a good example is in the first map that we were looking at, or the maps A and B that you have, where it comes from Highway 17 down Cunningham or Main Street to the city to 14th, that's all above ground there, that section. Whereas that might make sense for it to be above ground until those two properties to the north develop. When they underground the rest of the lines, then it makes sense to underground the fiber optic at that time, versus it might cost, you know, $500,000 to extend that underground that entire length, and it might not be proportionate to pay that $500,000 for the one provider that it's coming to. So I mean, there are examples where it would come out, but again, the big question is there that nexus between health and safety and welfare to extend it above ground? Terry, you know, is only reinforcing that argument that there are health and safety reasons that are, you know, that need to be overcome. So, you know, if they were hooking up a fire hall or a city hall so that the police chief could have emergency communications in all situations, that would clearly create that nexus for health and safety.
Thank you, Travis. Can we go back to Terry's, a couple of those pictures? And then I'd like to have Ian comment. Like, for instance, I mean, for instance, let's just say for the sake of argument, because I don't know whether this is an Avista pole or a Big Bend pole, you're the main person on the pole with the power, and then you have what appears to be somebody came in and either put a phone line or some kind of another type of a line, and then they didn't abate their wire. Is that a good assumption, that there was no wire abatement done?
No, that's a very good assumption, yeah.
So is there nothing in our ordinance that addresses wire abatement? Because if these utility companies are going to come in, and they are going to do work on their pole, they're going to run a line, shouldn't they be required to abate the line that, you know, that they should abate the old line? I mean, what would I'm just asking for direction. And since you guys own most of these poles in town, and is there any advice you could give this fellow city council tonight as to what would be a good direction to go with? Just, I mean, how do they police this in other areas, or is this just a common occurrence everywhere?
This is really common everywhere. When I talk to my, we call these joint users. Mm-hmm. I have a bad term, I guess. But
yeah.
But anyway, we have this problem everywhere, and mostly in small towns. And CenturyLink, we haven't had any problems with the fiber companies, but CenturyLink in particular, is they're usually the last one off, and we have the hardest time, and Terry will attest to this, getting them to pull the pole. But I do have to accept, take on a little bit of responsibility here, and that I could do a better job communicating with them as well. I mean, we go, you know, we'll have a pole fire, we have all kinds of reasons why we change poles, right? And sometimes it takes me a while to communicate that to CenturyLink. So some of these they don't know about until either I call them or Terry calls them. So this isn't, you know, some of this can be on my shoulders. But at any rate, it does take a long time. They are required. What our contract with all the joint users say is within 60 days, they have to have that pole out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then we can go down, we can go pull it and tie up their wires with ropes and send them a bill for the time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't ever do that. I don't have the time to do that. So it's kind of a quandary, I guess, you know.
So what could the city do, Travis, in terms of having some kind of an abatement ordinance or added to our codes that if these situations occur, is there some kind of a penalty that we can assess? Or is that something you'd like to take a look at and then report later?
I'm assuming that we would be able to go after some kind of code enforcement issue on that. I know in the cell tower ordinance, for example, there is specific language in there that gives them X amount of time to remove it, and then they have to, or then the city has the authority to go in and remove it for them and send them a bill for that. So I know it is in the code. Whether or not it's clearly laid out for these type of utility purveyors, I can't tell you off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But Kurt from Vrellin Associates pointed out that a lot of that would be in the franchise agreement that we would have with each of the individual providers. Mm-hmm. And if we have one, assuming we have them, which we may not, that's something that should be written in there. And even if we do have them, that should be specifically pointed out in there.
Yeah.
I think the cable companies are basically notorious because everybody's getting dishes now, and so you get all this cable run, and when you see wires wrapped up like that on the pole, I'll bet you know that is cable. Used to be cable TV run to somebody's house.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, this is a problem throughout the United States. Frank Nealand is the joint use director at Avista, and a number of years ago he took over, and he saw what really took 50 years to create. This problem really is done over time, and so what Frank has essentially adopted is the utility providers of today, or fiber optic installers of today, will pay for the sins of the past. And so when NOAANet were to apply for this pole, we would not be granted an attachment, and I want to make this a general statement because there are probably situations where it would be different, but generally speaking, we would not be allowed to attach until every joint user on this pole corrected their violations. And so by Avista, or Frank Nealand, by taking that policy, he's enabled to, by natural selection, resolve this problem over time. It would be impossible for Avista or any joint use owner throughout the state to fix all of these violations in a 5-year time span. I mean, you're talking of millions upon millions of poles. So I'm trying to defend Avista to some degree, yet at the same time, they did let this happen. You know, and at the same time, the phone companies and the cable companies, they did all these installations and they did them all poorly, and shame on them. And so as a city who holds their franchise, you have all the power in the world. Right, they can either play by your rules, or they don't get to play at all, right? But you've got to weigh that. You've got economic development that has been proven that fiber optic does for a city. Broadband brings economic development to a community, but you also have safety and aesthetics to worry about, and there's a balancing act. So you've got to use your strength, you know, of your franchise that you hold as your tool to fix this problem, and work diligently to get it corrected. But you know, I commit to you, this will not be something NOAANet does. You know, if we vacate a service, we'll vacate the cable. Our storage loops will be put up there correctly. We won't have cables hanging. And if we do, call me and we'll come and fix it. And if I don't, you know, Terry can say, Chris, it's time for you to come down and apologize to the city council personally, and I'll do that. So, and that's just my suggestion. You got put in a hard place, I apologize, but this will get corrected. And then furthermore, if you talk about city ordinances, you know, adopt a dig once policy. There's various full flavors of dig once, but dig once essentially says that if you're going to build a new area, that all the utilities have an opportunity to put their conduit systems in the ground when those trenches are open. You know, all those new developments, whether it's housing or Target or Walmart or Conoco, they've all got to open up trenches for electricity, cable, phone, fiber, right? Dig one's policy, the trench is open. Terry has a system where we're all notified. We all come in, we lay our conduit, and then it's buried, asphalt, and we're done. And if Nona doesn't do it at that time, well, shame on us. We don't get to, you know, provide services. But that's a dig once policy. Another dig once policy is when these poles do have to get replaced because of age or overloading, and you've got a four city block span, you also have a road widening happening or a sidewalk replacement, then you have a dig once policy. And Terry contacts all the utility providers, so Vista comes, CenturyLink comes, Northland Cable comes, Nona comes, and we all transition to an underground implementation, right? And we all share the costs. And so that $100,000 isn't necessarily a burden of Nona's because we're building it individually. It's a dig once policy, and we're all putting in at the same time. Will this happen instantaneously? No, but it's a policy that you have that 15 years from now, these problems, you know, slowly start to go away. So
I agree, and I want to thank you for that, Chris. I do have one other question. What's driving this request to put in the new line that you're talking to the council about?
Most state agencies are moving beyond the T1 line. Have you heard of that? Mm-hmm. It's a 1.5 megabit service that you can get from the local telephone company. Usually they can bond two or three together, maybe get 9 meg or what have you. And they're all into that 10 meg, 100 meg, or gigabit service level. And so most of the existing copper facilities that you see on those poles aren't going to support that. So even CenturyLink's bringing fiber, just like we are.
So what if the city of Othello made that request, and we wanted a fiber line here to the city?
Absolutely. In fact, we have a representative assigned with Nona who communicates with your Stan on a number of occasions trying to work out that same solution. And now we're by Terry's office as well by building up to that cell tower. So we're strategically located both the office there and the office here.
So basically reading the last paragraph of this letter that you've given us, you want to pursue the less cost.
Correct.
Primarily because you pass that cost on to the Washington State Department of Agriculture?
Correct. Yeah, we're a nonprofit agency, so...
Is there a representative from the Washington State Department of Agriculture here?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you're doing it on their behalf?
Well, I'm doing it on your behalf. The city needs fiber optics, and
yes,
one of your business, well, this one's a public service agency, but, you know, needs that circuit, and so either we're going to be able to provide it, or they won't be able to get it.
Okay. What exists on the poles that you're actually trying to go across? Can you, you know, I mean,
do we know
a better presentation would have been
like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. John, I wish I could have given you a better presentation, but I personally have never seen them. So I have design engineers that go down there. They do these designs and they put them in front of me for approval.
Okay.
So.
But could we get that? Could we see that?
Sure. I mean, Terry, you think you could talk about it? Are they those poles? Are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not sure what's on them, really, to be honest with you. You go by the irrigation district and they run by straight up past the housing authority and then past time out, and they drop into, I think, what Chris is doing, the egg building there, or the Washington State Park thing.
Back to my previous statement, though, the Avista policy would, I guarantee you, require all the make ready necessary for us to install on those poles. So there could not be an approved application without us having repaired any safety violations or the current tenants repairing any safety violations. That is Avista's policies on new attachments. Visually, I don't know what they look like.
And you currently have a franchise with us?
Correct. 2012, I think we obtained it.
Did I comment in?
Well, I shouldn't say this on the record, but they don't look anything like this. I know that. We just replaced one a couple of months ago in that alley, and I think it has bone on it, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Maybe
it's,
two.
It's
users.
Very little that exists in the alley other than a few housing.
Yeah. We were able to transfer and pull the old pole on that one, I remember, just because there was nothing on it. And if you'd like, I could run over and take a picture of it and email it to Spencer and show it, you know, I mean, if you want to do something like that right now.
Well, we don't have to make a decision right now. If you want to bring back information to us and present it to staff, and staff can bring it to our attention at the next meeting, This is a workshop. We don't vote in a workshop, so nothing's going to happen tonight. So if you want to better prepare for your request, it is an $80,000 savings. It is with an entity that we dearly need in this area, and we need to satisfy them. I mean, there's Washington State Department of Agriculture people at both of the large facilities that support this area. But we want to be able to make an informed decision. This does look terrible, Terry. I agree with you. I can see the need for the ordinance when this situation...
Well, I think the intention of the ordinance is to eventually get rid of the aerials. Because, number one, they're unsightly. And number two, you know, anytime there's big wind or anything like that, we have issues with power outages. And it'd be nice if everything was underground.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Council?
Just a quick question. It looks like you've got an aerial line that's already existing running down 7th.
Correct.
And we're going to be coming off of that.
Correct.
And down that alleyway. So it'd just be a leg off.
Yeah.
I just want to confirm what you're saying, though. You're saying with Avista's new regulations they have, if you come up on a real nasty pole, if this goes through, mm-hmm. before you can run your stuff, all the other companies have to clean their stuff up first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually sent in a draft structural design drawing. Shows, you know, who's attached, where they're attached at, what the violation is, and then Frank's team, Frank Greenland's team, comes back, and so all those violations have to be corrected, and so notices will go out to the phone, cable, and so forth, and then we can attach once those are corrected, or we're allowed to correct them ourselves, and so we'll move them accordingly up and down the pole if necessary.
So you'd actually clean them up?
I'm sorry?
You'd actually clean them up?
They would be cleaned up, yes.
Yeah. And if there was too much already hung on the pole, we get a larger pole.
Avista would place a larger pole.
Okay.
At our expense, we pay for it. So it's really, even aerial in a situation like that is not advantageous for us, because in that picture, it would be cheaper for us to go underground.
And Terry, did you have anything further you wanted to say?
I just want the council to understand that the reason I'm standing up here is for the city. Basically, because the ordinance was established by council and our standards. So we're just holding up that standard for council. So I want council to understand that. We're by no means picking on NoNet here. We just have a standard. My hands are tied. But I want Chris to explain the one that currently hit my desk that hooks up to Cemetery Drive and runs to down Industrial Lane to Lab.
Have you got any mobile communications? Hopefully there's room for us, another fiber transport provider, to speak about some of the issues.
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Josh Vasilius with Knoll Communications, and we have a lot of the same concerns that NoNet has. In 2007, we partnered with Adams County to bring fiber aerial from Highway 24 just south of the canal down there, so it's about 3.5-4 miles south on Highway 24. We constructed aerial all the way up Highway 24 by the John Deere. I think that's Industrial.
Industrial Lane.
Mm-hmm. So we come down Industrial, we dropped fiber into John Deere there, we dropped fiber into the Sheriff's Office, we come up basically up 7th, and we're co-located at Adams County Courthouse. The reason for that project was, back then, CenturyLink was the only player in town, and with Ritzville being the county seat for Adams County, Othello was kind of off the map when it came to getting broadband services. So we struck a deal where Adams County paid for the majority of the bill, and it allowed us to get that fiber structure, 90%+ aerial, into downtown. That allowed us to get off old T1s and onto an Ethernet service for a much more cost-effective price. When we did that, we also built in Columbia Basin Health Association. We connect the library back to Tri-Cities in partnership with NoNet. We both provide services to Othello Community Hospital, because at the time, they were only able to get DS3s, which is 28 times the T1. We were able to get at 45 meg. We were able to give them 100 meg for half the cost via this fiber that we have running around town. We built as far north as Simplot and the SVC location up there. Trying to think where else. So Lat Irrigation is a new customer for us.
we built from Sean's location at that irrigation, I think that that's concrete, north, about seven poles out there. There's no other utilities that I believe that are on there, other power. Vista gave us the right to say, hey, everything looks clean, go ahead and construct your fiber and everything. But we had an underground piece that got dug up, so we moved some splice cases around. And right now we're at a standstill because we weren't actually aware that the underground proposal was passed last night. So we've been about 5 weeks in standstill of connecting the last 60, 70 feet or so to get lat irrigation up and running. To this point, they've only had a wireless option, which is not feasible for their needs. We did the numbers. It cost us about $6,000 to construct that. If we had to go underground for that same span, it'd be closer to $30,000, which Sean would have to bear pretty much the entire cost because, you know, it doesn't make ROI sense for us to, you know, put something in the ground for somebody to use. So that's the big concerns that Mobile Communications has going on almost 8 years of being around here and picking up those larger entities that need healthcare, whatever, school, all that. That's just some of the concerns, I guess, that we have that we weren't aware a lot of that stuff was coming forward. We have fiber into this building. We have fiber into Public Works. We got you guys off T1s 7, 8 years ago, something like that. So I'm just here to express our concerns. Apologize, I didn't have an awesome presentation. I wasn't sure what the workshop meant. I was just coming to talk.
Council, you have any question? Okay. As John pointed out earlier, this is a city council workshop, so we don't make any decisions tonight. I think it's something we're going to have to address in a regular council meeting as far as a decision, not only with this, but what we intend to do going forward. So that may or may not be by our next council meeting, but I would anticipate by the end of this month we'll have a decision.
Okay.
That would,
And that is regarding all of the underground use or our particular case with LAD irrigation that everyone talked about?
Okay, I wasn't aware of the LAD until you just brought it up.
Okay.
So I think that the council is going to have to make a decision as to what and how it wants to proceed, whether it wants to do a case-by-case basis, whether you want to just hold to the ordinance, or just exactly how you want to proceed. So I think that a lot of information has been presented tonight, and it's been helpful for, I believe, the council and for myself to understand more about it, because I don't think we really understood what is actually, you know, I know councils can adopt ordinances and they can grant variances and they can do different things. I would assume that if they were to elect to allow you to run an aerial, the last however many feet that is over to LAD irrigation, that you would have to apply for a variance according to our current code, and that would have to go through the Planning Commission and a process. So it's not dead in the water yet, but it's also not a yes yet either. So as long as you understand that, the council will make that decision. Right, council? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is there anything I can prepare, I guess, for next meeting that would help?
Council?
Prior to the next meeting?
What additional information do you guys want to help you come to reach a decision? Terry, we've received information from the city.
I don't have any understanding of what your franchises are. So basically you're telling me that if you go onto a pole and you're going to be attaching to it, you're going to clean up the pole before you even can put your wire up there. So we're remedying a situation, a bad situation. I don't see that as a bad thing. I'm all for that.
If it's a safety violation, they're going to clean it up. Is that pole in violation, that last picture of the pole up there? How many violations are there?
Yeah, there's an amount
of violations. So he's going
to... We said it would be cheaper to go underground than to clean it out.
We would go underground because it's too expensive for us.
We've got those poles all over town, in all the alleys.
Well, then we need to start looking at our franchises with the people that are already... If franchise to hook onto the poles like that that were previously done and look at enforcing those franchises. We can't, it's really bad to say to people that are coming in and looking at doing something new, well, we've had bad people doing things, bad things.
So we're not going to allow you.
We're not going to allow you to do those same bad things when we're not exercising any, you know, franchise, you know, authority to say, go back and clean up your poles.
Yeah.
Find out who it is that's doing that and get them to clean it up.
I think what we need to do is to revisit, whether it's in committee or by staff or both, revisit the ordinance. I think that we had good intention passing the ordinance, you know, wanting to clean up what's existing out there. But maybe there's a happy medium where, like the dig once, if those things can be incorporated so that we're not completely shutting out growth, but are working towards eventual cleaning up the aerials and going underground.
Who would like to be on that committee?
I would.
Okay, we got two. I need one more.
I'll do it.
Corey?
Okay.
Then I'll task you to come back with, after you've researched our franchise agreements and our ordinances, make a recommendation to the council.
You want us to work with Travis on that?
Travis and the Public Works Department. Feel free to contact, get the contact information from Chris Walker and from
Josh
from Noel. And also Ian, and gather as much information as you want and come back to recommend to the council a direction forward. Okay? All right.
Yeah, the distribution methods that we use versus a cable plant or the copper plant are much different. So they look completely separate.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. Moving on to item 2.02 on our agenda, ADA discussion. And Terry, you had prepared some information for us to take a look at.
Yeah, we've wanted to take council back here for a few years, back to 2011. Been asked by the mayor to kind of address the council of where we've been, what we've done on the ADA side, so that you as council know that we work within the budgets and try and cover all the bases and the things that we've got going on. So I'm going to show you some things that we've got going, and starting back in 2011. This is just kind of an overview, running it up the ladder here, just as the progress that we've made, so that you don't think that we're just kind of running in place here. These are kind of the rundown of the project: City Hall ADA upgrades in 2011, Scutney Street project in 13, installed sidewalks around Park Ballards in 13, new restroom, ADA access sidewalks completed in 14, special park ADA restroom suite to be used to in the events, which we just had up at the park, worked out great, handled about 300 people. It had three places of business to do with the ramp. We put out porta potties, and then the last there, we hired GNO to do an existing curb ramp inventory, which we completed in 2014. We'll start with City Hall up here. That's the main, where the main business is done. We installed back in 11, we installed ADA doors right out front here, east side of the foyer with buttons, outside, inside. They're automatic doors and they're set up to work off the buttons. There's a button on the inside. We added an extension to the counter up front to handle wheelchair accessible people at the counter. We've also adjusted and had tested the door closures so that they were ADA approved. They got to be a certain poundage in order for them to open it up as being in a wheelchair. We added speakers to this system in here, new hearing devices. out on Scutney Street, we did an overlay on the street, grinding overlay. We did some sidewalk, curb gutter. Here is down by 4th and Scutney. You can see we've redone the approaches on the sidewalks here, the curb gutter at this location. Several of these were done. You can see we added our crosswalks. We did our pit ramps on both sides of the street here. You can see
sidewalks going to nowhere.
Pardon me?
You got sidewalks going to nowhere.
We put truncated domes here, which are required by law. We've got ADA grates for our storm grates.
Just a second, Terry. John, go back up a couple of slides.
We did all this work, and those sidewalks don't go anywhere?
That's by ADA regulation. So if that street going that way were to be developed, then the sidewalk, curb, and gutter would be developed. So when we redo a street, that curb, as part of it, has to be the ADA standards. You'll see some driveways the same way.
This road was done, not
sorry. I was just joking, though. I mean, it's, you know, you got sidewalks that go to nowhere now.
Not our choice. It's not by regulation.
You know, they don't even, the fellows that run around town on the wheelchairs, they don't even use the sidewalks. They just tool right down the street.
Smoothly.
I think they could get ticketed, couldn't they?
Would you like to answer that, Chief?
I would have to be sure to stop.
Continue on, Terry.
So this is down at Shady Lane. We did all four corners here. Kids were crossing across the street from here to there. They were diagonal here to here. They were all using a park to cut to the school. When this street went in, these were lawns. These were just over here, this one right here. And this corner was just, basically there was really nothing there, just grass. If you're going to send them from one side to the next, that's that. One side to the next, you have to build it. You can't send them to nowhere. So we had to build them. So we crosswalked here, we ped ramped over there. As you can see, we bring it up to grade. If it's going to continue down that side of Shady Lane on either side of that, something happens to either one of these lots, we're going to ask them to extend that sidewalk to the end of the property line. Here's the one that wasn't built at all. And you can see we bring it right up here after we do our transition ramps right here, our truncated domes, everything comes up to ADA standards. This one here had this, I don't know, you probably all remember this great big tree that sat in the yard over here. It had grown clear out. It was clear into the parking lane, and it pushed up the curb gutter, sidewalk, tore up this whole sidewalk transition right here. So this was part of, this approach right here was part of that when we did Scutney Street. We had to go back in there and we had to retransition that because it was broke up so bad. All of these were done to ADA standards when this road was put in. Here's another one here where we've transitioned, and then the property owner will have to carry on. This is 7th and Scutney here. This is the tail end of it. You can see we've done sides on those corners, making this more accessible for kids because a lot of kids use this. In the same project, this was a vista. This is a utility easement behind in the south end of Kiwanis here. It has to be open so that a vista can get to the poles down there. We have a sewer line down there, a couple manholes. So this was an ADA approach that we put in. This used to be a solid curb, probably 12 inches high. People used to jump over it with their pickups and across the park they'd go, both trailers, the works when I came here. So we made this an ADA and we put the safety bollards in. As you can see to the right there's a truncated dome. There's an ADA ramp to access what we were going to have as a restroom there. We did this in with speculation that restroom was going to go there. Bollards, sidewalks in the park. This is the south end of Kiwanis. We put the gates in because of the previous chief, we had a hard time controlling traffic in the park. He said, until you can shut the park off, we can't really do much about the traffic that just decides to cut over there, grab a table, and shag out of town. So we built these, and the Public Works built the gates, and we installed them, and then we ADA'd around them to compliance so that this walk path still worked without the gates being open. We did this in every one of the parks to control traffic, because they all wanted to use the park with their vehicle. This is another portion down at the large shelter at Kiwanis. We did the same thing here. This is an ADA walk path right here. It is asphalt here, and it goes around the corner to the restroom ramp off to your right behind the tree. We excavated this out and made this transition so that anybody with a wheelchair possibly can make that restroom, because the ADA, the ramp over there to that restroom is ADA. So in 2014, we put a new restroom in. This restroom is fully ADA compliant. It has LED outside lighting. It has motion sensor lighting inside, auto dimming if there's nobody present. It has an ADA water fountain here. This water fountain actually drains back into the building, so there's nothing out here to freeze in the cold winter. It has auto locks on it, so we set the locks to time out with the park hours, so the police officers don't have to come lock it. There is a plumber's closet or chase in the back where it's, that portion of it's heated. That's where our connections come through. It's where our hot water tank is. This is an all concrete structure. It's up above. This is, comes in a half section. You can kind of see, I wish this pin would work right here, but you know, there it is. Right there you can see where we've mudded in some cable. Great big nuts, and they ratchet it together, they pull it together completely tight, and then they mud the top in, and then they cover the caps right here on the corners. So it's pulled in and they hydraulically jack them together. We did the pad, we poured the sidewalk, we did the plumbing under the ground attached to a manhole out back here that currently ran to the big shelter that's over here, and we had tied this bathroom all in at this location. So this one is got a vandal shield on the outside. They come with a sealer, and if you hit it once with graffiti, if you scrub it with a brush to get it off, it'll come off, but you scrub that off. So we were able to go back factory, get the ingredients and the name and all that, and went through our supplier for, well, $7,500 through the factory, but it's $200 through our supplier for the same stuff. And when this went down, we squirted this up. So this here has it on it, but it doesn't come off. It stays on. Every 5 years, you recoat it. So if you scrub it, wash it, pressure wash it, it won't come off. The graffiti will, but not the shield.
Nice.
So we put a lot of thought into this. It's all concrete. You're going to beat yourself up in there trying to get things off the wall, because it's pretty well hammered in pretty tight. So it is a nice structure, very nice structure. Floor drains, we wash them out, clean them up, and they look really good.
You got the, that's pretty much what you're going to put in up at Lyons?
This is probably the duplicate of what will go up at Lyons at the corner up there. There's one, I can't remember the count of urinals and toilets and sinks in here, but the one that we would propose to look at Lyons is got an extra sink and another urinal and a couple more toilets. It's a little bigger and had a little more capacity, so to replace the one that we've got up there currently. But this would be the one that we would put up at Lyons.
And so are we still planning on doing that this year?
If I get the word, it takes about 90 days to order, to get to make.
Didn't and then I have to. We voted on it. No, I think we put it off on the budget, because we didn't have the money, but we were going to look at it.
Spencer, do you remember what we did?
2 years ago we did. We voted.
Yeah. Okay, I was here. 2 years ago.
We decided to pay $400,000 for utility tax and the remaining.
Okay. Okay, I was here. 2 weeks ago.
Say you can order it.
Yeah.
So if somebody just shoots me an email for documentation purposes, I'll spend money.
Smart answer.
Jerry, bless you.
I don't think he was here then either.
So in the Lyons version.
Actually, Dan should have told you, because Dan was here.
It must have slipped through his cowboy hat.
That was the night that Dan was here.
That did.
So We would do the same thing. Staff would do the same thing. We have a line that comes from the pool that comes out onto Pine. We would dig that line and set that grade. We would set the pad and everything like that. It just takes 90 days from start to finish here, and then it's a delivery. When we're ready, they deliver it. They hook it up. We connect the water to it and everything. So if I got the green light, I'll make it happen. So somebody shoot me some material, and I'll get it going.
Cool.
This is the inside of it. Pretty clean. Not a lot in there. It is also shot up on the inside, so vandalism, you can clean that off. This is the new spot that we put it, the large shelter. This is up by well 3. It'll be out on this high spot right here. It'll have sidewalk all the way around it, but it will connect. Sidewalk will connect back to the walk path so that you can get to the restroom from the walk path.
Good location.
And this is our collector's edition version of, and this one's been here a while. It's served its purpose long overdue. This is the one in the middle of the park here. And I've got a couple shots on the inside. This is one direction and a door between this wall here and this wall here. Pretty tight. At that time it was put up, it would have qualified. But today, that won't qualify. And that wall there basically protects this ongoing running urinal. This has a tube here that constantly runs water. In our day and age, I would think that that's probably not a good thing for us. The water is precious commodity at this time. So this is the one that we would replace. There's been some talk about Public Works just gotten this one and using it for a storage that was brought up, which makes sense. We can stock a lot of our toilet supplies and things for the parks in here. We've got the room, we just knock the walls out, leave it there, and then set the other one off to the side, plumb it in, new pad, and put a new bathroom in it. Water and everything's there. This is for the people that didn't make it down the park or didn't make it into this restroom. Most people don't go look in the restrooms like they do houses. But this is the new one that we put out in the park for ADA compliant, to help out with our ADA compliant issues that we have. There's only one of its making on this side of the mountain. It's a pretty precious guy. It's air conditioned. It's got all the bells and whistles, vacate occupancy up here on the lights, full ADA wheelchair access here by the ramps. We had it set in just south of the hockey rink. Interior pictures here.
So did we rent that, Terry?
Yes, we rented it for the event. It's on wheels, it's self-contained, water's in it. Got a big water tank, big holding tank. It just needed a 20-amp circuit, which we had off the shelter. We set it up. The wheels jack up on it and down on it, so you can set it down as far as you can, level it up. A really, really nice facility. It got used. Right at about 10 o'clock, it was just about capacity. And we opened it up, about noon, Wade?
About 11:30.
Yeah. So it worked. It was kind of centrally located, and it added quite a bit to the event. So this is the other part of the rooms in here. Sink, soap. And towards the end of 14, Gray and Osborne did an inventory across town of our existing curb ramp inventory, and they did a study, and we paid for that. And we have some things there that we need to look at and consider maybe redoing them. We have a action plan yet to go. We have a budget yet to put together for those action plans and kind of attack some of those or check some of those that are high priority, kind of seem to be out of kilter. But we're going to do that with our new engineering firm, Varilla, is working on that to come up with an action plan and a budget, possibly, and spending $25,000-$30,000 a year towards ADA.
To upgrades. Make things,
pardon me?
Upgrades.
Upgrades within the city. So that kind of takes care of all the presentation that I've got on ADA. It was just kind of an overview to kind of let council know where we come from, what we've been doing behind the scenes while you guys are out working. We haven't totally been idle sitting by. We have been as proactive as we can be with crew and budget. So if there are any questions, I'll answer those.
Terry. Travis, is ADA something that we would want to address in our comprehensive plan?
I would think that ADA is something we could address both in our facilities chapter and in our transportation chapter, because it equally applies to both, whether it's buildings or transportation infrastructure.
And this next meeting is on?
Transportation.
Okay, good. Thank you. Terry, thank you very much. Yes.
I missed it. My new engineering firm reminded me, you know, First Avenue and 14th, you'll have upgrades on that for ADAs when we do those grinding overlays. So that'll be another part of the plan knocked out. So, FYI.
Thank you, Terry. Moving on to item 2.03, well number 9, engineering cost review. We have with us the gentlemen, Jesse and Dana Cowger and Kurt Varela. And were they going to start the presentation, or Wade, do you want to go ahead, Wade?
Mayor, Council, as you're well aware, that there's been some concern expressed about the cost of bringing Well 9 up to speed to pump water back into town. So based on direction from Council and those concerns, we directed the Varela Engineering to do some research. Staff did some research, looked at where we are with it, looked at the budget, looked at a lot of factors. And what we have tonight is the firm of Varela will present a more detailed summary of information on Well 9, what the cost entail, why they came to those cost numbers. Go back and look at it. In fact, I provided you all with what was originally costed out from a GNO. I just finally found information that actually Spencer found it for me today, and hence the late addition to the board docs. But those are some costs there. Varela will talk about why their costs are actually different than what GNO is, why that is. And I'm not going to go into detail now, let them do that. But what I'd like to do then is let them talk to you about those details. Please ask questions during the presentation. This would like to be an open discussion. Terry might have some stuff to add. I might have some stuff to add in my research as we go forward with this. So what this is a discussion briefing, basically, and a point to start discussion with these numbers. So without further ado, then I'll turn it over to Jesse and let him start his presentation.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Thanks for the opportunity to come back and go over this with you. The week before last, Mayor Logan and Dana Cowger were at the AWC conference together, and Mayor Logan relayed that the council had some more questions about this, so we've kind of spent the last week or so pulling together all the documentation and figures that both show the basis for our estimate, and then also try to intercept some of the questions that we understand the council has on it. So in order to do that, I guess I wanted to start with the general, and then we'll get down to the specific nuts and bolts of what we understand the questions are. But starting off initially, wanted to talk about the whole project development part. So big picture, where did this start? What are some of the intermediate facts, and where are we now? So initially, 2011, your water system plan identified the need for basically an additional 1,500 gallons a minute of supply capacity in order to meet your water supply needs for the future. And at the time that plan was developed, the amount that they thought they would get from each well was in kind of the 800 gallons a minute range. So the plan then was to have two new wells, well 9 and well 10. And those cost estimates, initially when the plan was developed, were about 2.7 per well. And then they've since been updated to when the specific locations of those wells were identified, was that you know, the well 9 would still be around 2.7. I think it got adjusted to 2.9 with project inflation as those estimates were developed.
And just let me interrupt you for just a second. And I'm going to do this throughout this as I give you some information I found. What we found, and where this is coming from, our old engineering firm, GNO, for whatever reason, decided that those wells would be about a 500-foot well, and you guys know what that would produce, and would produce about 750 gallons per minute. That was, I believe, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't really consult with staff that much on that. Otherwise, we would have said, you know, stand by one. You know, we need something more. And as you guys, some company came into office, John, you, and Corey, and a few of you, and started looking at this closer, you remember we said, wait a minute, GNO, that's not what we want. We want to go down deeper. But that was the plan, and that was that budget you put in front of you, that was what that was based on, was this very inadequate plan. So we started working with that. So as GNO, as Rella came on board, then they're dealing now with the upgraded well and stuff. So, Jesse.
Right. So, anyway, kind of the thrust of this first slide is what Wade's saying. Initially, we thought we'd have to have two projects, and it was in the neighborhood of $5 million. As the facts have developed, you know, in terms of drilling that well, you guys got a great well in terms of capacity. 1,500 gallons a minute is a good well in this area. So that's great. And the reason it's significant is that the project there is not the same project you have now. So moving on, I guess, to the next one here. So the current project costs, as they've fallen out, we went over this with Spencer, and this isn't a detailed breakdown, but it's roughly where the dollars have been spent thus far in terms of the well drilling, the transmission main. That's including engineering for those first two. And then the third line item there is that $1.2 million that the council is saying, hey, explain this number to us, which is what we want to do here. And then you total those up and wind up with that $2.8 million. And so circling back to that water system plan, estimated budget, you know, 4 years ago, and then you adjust it for inflation, and you're right in that ballpark. So I guess all we're trying to show the council is that even with the changes to this project in terms of the capacity you're actually getting out of the well, you're still close to what you were initially thinking you were going to spend. So let's get into the numbers in a little more detail. I'm sorry, that's probably a little difficult to read. I don't know if does it show up on your tablets or I think this went out in council documents. Is this our estimate? Okay. So that's our estimate there, and Wade forwarded to us an estimate that you guys apparently had reviewed from Gray and Osborne, which I think was developed in 2013. Is that correct?
It was. Yeah, the council got it, actually, the staff got it in January of 13, okay. But it was based on June of 2012 data. So it's you know, three-year-old numbers, basically.
Okay. And we're going to get to the specifics on it, but if we can just go just a little bit further before we get into, like, really drilling down into each of those line items. So I guess the first big-picture question that we're assuming the council has is, hey, we got $1.2 million in your detailed estimate. We have this one from Gray and Osborne that's for a significantly lower dollar amount. So we want to address that right away here. So, Spencer, is it okay if you jump to that spreadsheet that we had up? So, Kurt Holland and I were working on this on the way over, because, like I said, we actually got this estimate today, the Gray and Osborne one, and I guess to answer the question with the quick answer, and we'll get to the more details of it. Okay, why is the GNO estimate lower? And there's kind of three main reasons. The first one being the capacity issue. This estimate was developed before the well was drilled. No one knew what the capacity was going to be. Everyone was assuming 700-800 gallons a minute. So it's a lower capacity pump station for one. And based on their line item estimates there in terms of the motor controls, it appears that it doesn't include a VFD, which the city wants on this pump station. So there's a cost item there. I was going to have Kurt explain this.
No, that's right.
Yeah, because he did the spreadsheet stuff there, and he can chime in here as I'm doing it. But
So if the dollars aren't exactly what you're looking at, I was doing this in the car on the computer, so I didn't ground up and.
Yeah. So anyway, the first main answer to the question is capacity. So it's an estimate for a pump station that's roughly half the capacity of the one that's currently being proposed.
Yeah, so we're looking at
this one. Where are you?
This 150 versus 180.
Yeah, so this column here is the numbers off of that GNO estimate. And this column here is where we think the changes would be based on that capacity change. So these little notes off to the side here say, okay, instead of 150,000, they estimated for a bell pump and motor. We think it's more in the 180 range. Electrical telemetry, VFD, same thing. You know, this cost for a VFD, there's the water system plan also had an estimate for adding a VFD to well 8, and that $80,000 is what they estimated for that one. So there's a cost change there. And basically, we adjusted the estimate for time, because that was in 2013, so cost of construction based on indexes and inflation is roughly 8%. The construction contingency is what GNO had a 10% contingency. Our estimate, the one that we'll go back to in a minute, we've used a 20% contingency, and so that we'll go into why we think a 20% contingency is what the city should budget, and we can have a back and forth on that. But anyway, long story short, I guess, once you adjust the GNO estimate numbers for the bigger capacity, you wind up right in the same neighborhood we have for that 1.1, 1.2 million. So we actually saw it more as a confirmation of the numbers we've given you than a, oh my gosh, how could they do it for that? I think maybe we'll jump back to our specific estimate now, if we can.
Can we stop just for a minute?
Sure.
Council, do you have any questions so far?
It doesn't correlate with what we have in front
and
of us.
I have a slide specifically for that, John.
I
have several things in mind that I wanted to talk about that the well you've worked on. So
the only thing we have on our documents here is the old GNO estimate, correct? Okay. So we don't have any of.
We don't have
anything
changes
that you guys have here.
No.
The slides that
this is just all old GNO, because according to the numbers, that's exactly what was up there for the old GNO estimate.
Yes, yeah, so you don't have ours in your packet there. Is that what you're saying, Gina?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's what was.
That's all we have right there.
Those are the old GNO estimates.
But you know, the
first one, real quick, notice that the drilling for the 16-inch hole is only 480 feet. So when we were going over that, that's when we realized this was for the project outlined in the original water system plan, and not what actually occurred out in the field. The
right.
The hole is about 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
Right.
But how does that total cost for the whole reflect to what was actually spent?
These estimates here for.
Yeah, because it says total project estimate is 770,000. What did we spend, do we know, on that project?
Yeah, if you go back to the PowerPoint there. Yeah, that slide there, Spencer.
Slide here.
Yeah. So it again, these aren't super precise, but I think they're accurate. We went over them with Spencer in terms of the total dollars the city's expended on these things. And so to date, basically, with the drilling of the well and the transmission main, all the engineering and everything, you've spent about $1.6 million.
And remember, we went deeper than what we were going to still, so it added another 40-something thousand to it. It's on top of that. So.
You know, the other thing that the error I see in that other one is there's no cost for a pump in it.
Well, and it's the difficulty in comparing estimates from two different engineers. It's like what was included where.
Pump and motor.
It's down at the other one.
It's in
the other one. So if we go to page 2, equipping the well, you got pump and motor. Well,
there it is.
Yeah. So, okay, so we didn't exceed $900,000 for the drilling of the well. But we also did exploratory work. We know that we are getting the best available water source possible. And then we spent $700,000 roughly 700,000 on the transmission pipeline. Okay, that's there. So we've got 1.6 million into it. Don't dispute that.
Yep.
And they had budgeted roughly 1.5 million for that in their estimated costs. You agree?
Well, again, those old estimates, you know, were based on a different well and a different pump station. You know, they were at the lower capacity pump
station. Actually, they bid one, or they estimated 1.1 million on the transmission pipeline and 770,000 on the well. So,
so the well was more expensive. The T-main was less expensive.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So now we're discussing what we need to do for a pump station.
Right. Right. And let's see here. So this is the line item estimate here, and I think we can probably jump to what you were talking about, John. You know, what your experience has been here, because you know, you and I had a conversation. I did some more research on some of these things, and this is what I found. You know, I haven't seen your design drawings, and I have what you've described to me, and so I know that it's actually a higher capacity well. It's about the same depth, correct? Is yours 1,000 feet?
We're 940 feet.
Yeah, about the same depth. And 400 horse motor, correct?
400 horse.
400 horse motor.
600 foot set.
Yep.
So it's about 615 or so.
So in a lot of the stats, the well is slightly larger than the city's one. And so John's asking, hey, based on the numbers that he has in his hand, it appears that they've been able to do a lot of these things for a lot cheaper. So here's some of the, I guess, some of the possible reasons for that. Again, you know, I don't have the exact specifics to say for sure. You know, it's exactly this much different because of these reasons, but let's just go down through them. So in terms of the pump, you told me that Lane of Washington, roughly 160,000 for that pump that you're going to install in there. And, you know, we've estimated 180 for ours. And it's kind of like, okay, why is there a cost difference? Ours is higher capacity. It's a deeper set. And I guess...
well, we're pumping 1,870 gallons a minute.
1,870? Okay.
That's what our range is. We could go up to 2,300 if we wanted to.
Okay.
But our target is 1,870 gallons a minute.
Okay.
So that's what we sized our pump for.
Okay. So what I understand about that the pump that is going in is that the shaft is a carbon steel shaft as opposed to a stainless steel. And I haven't spoken with James Brock, but I know him. You know, and we've worked with him on other projects. And James does, or says Lane of Washington does a lot of irrigation applications, and they do some municipal applications. And the pump that's probably being installed is probably more of an irrigation line, or maybe you know, if it's an irrigation versus a municipal line, because the pump companies have different lines of pumps, and they use different materials, and they have different standards, including, you know, like even in terms of drinking water standards, drinking water pumps have to meet the no lead requirements for the impellers, all those sorts of things. And so they wind up being more expensive. That's really all I'm getting to, is that if it's irrigation versus municipal grade pumps.
We didn't buy an irrigation pump. We bought a municipal pump.
Okay. So
it's a 14 MJ. So whatever you want to take out of that. I can't give you every detail.
Yeah.
But it's the best you can get.
Yeah. So, and you also talked about the VFD thing. You know, you have a variable speed controller for your pump.
Yeah.
And what I also understand about that is that it's a package VFD, as opposed to an integrated one into a motor control center.
It's a package VFD with MCC and everything.
Yeah, and at least what I understand from electrical sub-consultants, the setups with VFDs into the MCCs. It's not strictly municipal applications, but for most municipal applications are just more expensive than the setup you have. And
I got way more control over my well than any city well today. And I'll probably have more control over my well than what you'll design to put in for well number 9. I can guarantee you that.
Okay, but let's stay relevant here. The council wanted to
hear more.
The council wanted to hear what these costs were and the reasons, so let's go on, Jesse.
Okay. Well, those are all component questions there. Okay, what specific components are being used? Some additional considerations about why McCann could potentially do it cheaper. And I discussed this with you also, John. In terms of how you have delivered that project, my understanding is that you've sort of been the project manager. You've essentially acted as the general contractor. And the way that would be different for a city project is that you wouldn't be going out for the individual pieces of the project. You wouldn't get necessarily a separate contractor for the building, separate for the electrical, separate for the pump. You would have one general contractor, and he would perform however much work he could do, and then he would have subcontractors. But it would all be the responsibility of the general contractor to coordinate all of those contractors, be responsible for all the equipment working together, and then also be responsible for warrantying the whole facility. So the difference there being that the McCann facility would have individual component warranties, whereas the city's facility would have a blanket warranty over all of the whole facility, and you'd only go to one person if there was a problem in the warranty period. So that translates to a cost. And so then additionally, just probably the easiest one to describe, prevailing wage rates on any public works project add 10 to 20%. And you know, I'm not super familiar, John, with what was required from a DOH standpoint in terms of what they wanted to see for overall plans and specifications in terms of a package. But you know, the Department of Health does have pretty strict requirements for a public water supply well, and so there's a cost associated with that. So I definitely understand why you're asking the question, saying, "Hey, it really seems like we have done this for a fraction of what the city, what we're saying the project for the city is going to cost." And I'm saying, "Well, these are the probable reasons for that."
Okay.
In terms of a basis for our costs, we really went through both our project cost histories and then also went out and found some that were from either surrounding communities or just ones that we didn't design, I guess, to give you guys some additional confidence in the numbers that we've put forward here. Actually, let me see here. And so within the pump station, there's kind of these three big ticket items that when you look back at our estimate, it's basically the well building itself, the pump and motor, and then the motor control center, which also contains the VFD. I mean, those all together are going to be three quarters of the cost of the pump station. So those specific line items from past projects are what we compiled for you here. So this is just for building. You know, we were looking at the dollars per square foot, and they always sound really high when you look at them. So we've got our building cost for each of these pump stations. There's quite a range, which you can see, and the square footage of those facilities, and then also the cost per square foot. So it's a range basically from $100 all the way up to $300 per square foot, depending on how big the building was, all that. And it's not to say that we're just compiling information from past bids here. And we think that $200 per square foot that we have in our estimate is in the range of what you're going to pay if you look at these. And if it's less, it's less. You know, if your bid comes in less and we're all wet on that construction estimate, that's fine. It's just there's a lot of history here for us saying this is what we've seen.
You know, a lot of that variability can also be just the contractors and how they package their estimate. Does the building square foot cost include some of the piping? I mean, Mark, you been through that, or is it in the yard piping? So sometimes you'll see a real high number or a very low number, and we don't really know what the contractor included in those numbers, but it gives you a pretty good range of what those costs can be.
Yeah, sorry. So this line here, above here, all these ones here are Varela projects. These ones below here are non-Varela projects. And the information we were able to gather was a little less complete for the ones we didn't do because we could only get what people would send us, basically. So, but I still think that the numbers still line up with what we're estimating for the project. So, The bottom one here is what we've estimated for the well 9 project here. So, all right. And I know that's a lot of numbers to try and digest here, just staring at them, and we can get them to you to look at in more detail, but I guess the thrust of it is that it, I guess we weren't just throwing darts at a dartboard. There is a lot of data behind what we were estimating there, and ultimately, the bid will be what it will be, and hopefully it's better than that, but there's the numbers. So, similar table here, but with motor controls and cost of pumps. And the other thing that this table is probably going to drive home is the effect of pump setting depth on the cost of the pump. And I had some real deep ones here that had real expensive pumps. And, you know, the shallow ones aren't as expensive. The thing that really pops out to me, though, also is that the cost of electrical is just darned expensive. I mean, you look at some of these smaller ones, you know, 250, 500 gallons a minute. Some of them are under 100,000, but, you know, a lot of these are in that $200,000 range, which is what we, on the bottom here, our estimate for pump and electrical is 200,000. So you can look at these, and you can look at the horsepowers, the flow rates, the pump setting depths, and you're always interpolating between, you know, what they might be. But yeah. Again, we think the numbers are a good conservative estimate for the city to use for the project going forward. Can I answer any questions on those two tables or?
So you set the pump at 390 feet in our well. That's the plan.
That's the recommendation of ASPEC. Yeah.
And in Ritzville, they're setting it at 860 feet down near the bottom.
Their well is really, really deep. It's over 1,000. I want to say it's like 1,400 feet deep or something like that. So it's not near the bottom, but it is deep.
Okay.
Why only 390 feet when we've got a 900 foot hole and all of our other wells are setting almost double like that?
Yeah, the static water level is higher in this well than a lot of your other wells.
Recharging a lot faster.
But how about 5 years, 10 years down the road?
Then you can lower it.
Yeah, it is a possibility, and it's when do you want to spend the money? And in addition to this well, the liner starts just at 400 feet there, so you're setting it just above the liner, and that liner is smaller, so you'll have to use smaller pump bowls, more stages. It'll be a more expensive, less efficient assembly if and when you have to lower it. So the idea, I guess it's kind of a cost-benefit thing. Hey, do we do it now and put it as low as we possibly can get it and have a really expensive, you know, a $300,000 pump item right now? Or do we put this in and hope it lasts a long time?
So basically, our static water levels are recharging very fast right now. We don't need to set it as low, so it saves us a lot of money at the
pumping cost with electricity. And mm-hmm.
Okay. What happens, though, in a hole? You have a water level. As that water level drops, when you're pumping harder, you lose head on top of the pump, so the pump efficiency drops off. So you get to an equilibrium point where your pump efficiency and your head on top of it equal out. And you're going to target an amount of removal, and that's all you're going to get. Because you could drop your bowls down to 900 feet like we have in well number one of our, but we lose so much head that we peg it at 1,525 RPMs and we get 650 gallons a minute to 700 gallons a minute, and that's it. We could take it up to 1,700 RPMs, draw it down, and get it within, you know, a 10-foot tolerance of the bowls, and not achieve anything.
You lose as much as you gain. Yeah.
Yeah, you lose that in head pressure, so the target, it equalizes itself at a point. So, but I guess Aspects has done is said you're going to get 1,000 gallons a minute, 1,500 gallons a minute, it's going to drop your head pressure to here, that's it. That's what you're going to do.
And that was an engineering model.
Yeah, and if you look at the pump test they did, And the chart says if the pump test, that bears out what John just said. So what they looked was the optimum point where that equilibrium occurs, and that's what they came up with.
So, yeah, so right now, the estimated long-term pumping level at 1,500 gallons a minute still leaves about 100 feet above the bowls. So there is some room for decline if that happens. And they've selected the operating, or we've selected the operating point such that we're to the right of the best efficiency point. So on a pump curve, that just means that basically if your head increases because the water level is decreasing, you won't immediately be inefficient, but by the time the water level is down near your bowls, it'll be like, okay, it's time for a new pump anyway. This one's not efficient. But, I mean, yeah. So.
Spence, what are we paying sales tax on?
What are we paying sales tax on?
Yeah.
The percentage or the?
Well, I think we pay the same sales tax that anybody else pays.
It says state sales tax on here, I think is what he's asking. What is that being paid on, just the equipment?
Yeah. We actually have to pay sales tax on putting in a well.
Even though it's a city.
We get some of it back.
Okay. So I just wondered about that. I had to ask that question. I was just wondering because this was a question that was asked of me by someone.
A lot of places don't think that we have to pay sales tax. So a lot of times when we pay invoices, places don't include sales tax. So we have to calculate that ourselves and make sure that the appropriate amount goes to that.
So basically, what do you think in your 20% contingency is going to cover for you? Because contingency is unforeseen engineering that did not get done that you have to deal with.
Yeah, we had a lot of discussions with the staff regarding the project and going in and their expectation levels. And supported those, but at the time we were a little uncertain on whether it was going to be the staff would like to go to Schneider Drilling to do a lot of work. And that does introduce an element of cost because it's not being competitively bid. We agree with staff that that is a beneficial thing as far as they're looking at over all your wells, they're doing maintenance on your wells. So if we go to a competitive bid, yes, there may be a cheaper bid coming in from Eugene, Oregon, but it's a company that's not familiar with Lavello. It isn't going to serve you as well. So the 20%, John, I mean, I looked at that too. Usually at this point in time, we'd be looking at a 10% contingency, realistic. But we weren't exactly sure on whether we were going to go as a proposal type to the drilling outfit preference or going to a competitive bid. So I recommended we leave it at 20% at that time.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with, we do want to work with Schneider, no question about it. But it wouldn't hurt to get a competitive bid from someone else that does deep water well pumps for the exact same well pump.
Right.
It wouldn't. No. You know, just to keep Chris honest.
Everybody honest, yeah. And I think that that's what they're proposing, but it's still not an open market competitive bid.
Okay.
And again, too, you know, like another question that I know that you had, John, and we talked about in the Public Works Committee meeting was in terms of the level inspection and construction involvement. And back on, I'll go back to, so on our estimate here, we're looking at these two numbers here. So this is design specifications contract docs. That's the $100,000 number there. And then this is the construction involvement from your engineers here. And, you know, if you do go with a contractor that you're comfortable with, it's very, and that we have confidence in, I mean, it's very likely that's way too much money. If you go to an open bid, you wind up with a bad contractor, probably need every bit of that. So it's a project estimate, and all this stuff here is time and expense work. You're only going to get billed for what's actually used and needed there.
Can I clarify your language?
Sure.
You're saying if we go to an open bid as if
we can control certain aspects of that. I think that needs clarification as to the aren't we operating under an emergency process? Therefore, we are not required to go to an open bid.
No, but there's nothing preventing you from getting more than one bid.
Correct.
So you're under an emergency situation. That means that you can go out and select.
I just wanted to clarify that this is under an emergency and why we can do
right.
this. That's all. I agree with you. We do need to, if for nothing else, to keep everybody honest. But I didn't want the newspaper to think that we're dodging the
process.
The process.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you have companies you've worked with before to build buildings that you could get a bid from. And basically what you're saying is if that 425 square foot building comes in higher than $20 a square foot or whatever, that you talk to them about what they're doing or go out and get a bid from somebody else.
The way the project is going to be packaged right now, your building won't be just packaged to go out for a building. It'll be basically the building, all the piping, and all the site work.
Yeah, I know that. But basically, you're going to hire a general contractor. They're going to sub out electrical. And so in the period that you're building the building, you're going to have them, electrical people laying conduit and things like that. There's only one pipe that stems up through the bottom of the building, and that's the discharge pipe. The rest of it will all be done after the building's built and connected to your wellhead.
So the city is hiring a contractor. We're assisting you with developing the contract docs to get that contractor on board. And so, yes, your contractor will be responsible for getting the building guy coordinated with the piping guy and all of that. And that's actually really one of the benefits of the way it's being packaged is that you have a general contractor that's doing all of that, as opposed to, you know, the way you did it, John, where you were acting as the coordinator for all of that. So our assistance during construction is making sure that they build it to the plans and specifications that we developed. And
so you're not going to develop a scope of work and develop a work calendar for which you want each task completed?
It's required that the contractor provide that. Say, this is my schedule, this is the order I'm going to approach the work with, and we monitor that, inspect the work as it happens, and hopefully, catch problems. That's
all right.
Okay.
And so you'd be overseeing that so that each milestone is met at the appropriate time from the contractor.
Yeah, we don't dictate means and methods of construction. We dictate the quality of the project.
Well, you'll write up a specification book, right? And you'll present that to the general contractor you decide to hire to do that. So everything that's purchased is purchased based on those specifications, equivalent to or better than this type of material.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
And they'll present the construction schedule, and we will make sure that they've followed that construction schedule. There will be an overall timeline for private completion. That limits this inspection cost. But we let them have the flexibility of means and methods and sequencing their work to their benefit.
Is there a reason you stretch it out so long, 16 weeks?
Well, again, it's kind of like those other tables that we had in terms of how long we see these projects take. And that's, if it's less than that, great. But it, again, our involvement would be on time and expense, whether it took that or it took 8 weeks, it would take half the time, and that would be to the city's advantage. But that's our experience of what those projects take to construct in terms of time.
Okay.
That may change as we get the contract documents developed. If we get a better handle on where the parts and pieces and procurement of the materials are, and we can make it 12 weeks, we'll make it 12 weeks. We'd love to see it built as quick as possible like everybody else does.
Well, I just see that the site prep is pretty much there. It's the city did a great job, where it's at. So I see footings going in pretty fast, you know, that stuff materializing, and then you're pouring the foundation and the floor and stuff, and I could see all that happening within 2 weeks. You're starting to lay block, you know, and have block 10 feet high, and, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, we'll see, and when we get the contractor on board and get a schedule from them, we'll see how they, you know, the person building it is laying out the timeline. And if we're all wet on that estimated time of construction, you're not going to pay for our services, you know, when nothing's going on there. So.
Yep. Okay.
I've got a little update for you, just in terms of where we're at on what you've assigned us. But can I address any more questions or concerns from council?
Nope. Okay.
Okay. Well, Thursday we sent review sets on the critical equipment packages. So basically, the well pump, the motor, the VFD that the city's going to move ahead with acquiring because of the timelines associated with those. Those are the long lead time items. So essentially, we got those over to you guys to be able to get that rolling. And then we've also sent a 50% review set for the building and site work. And staff's reviewing that. We're going to meet with them on Thursday, go over their comments, and once we have them, we'll integrate them and get you guys back a bid set for the equipment. And then we'll be integrating comments on the site work and stuff. And we're moving ahead, trying to get this thing done as quickly as possible for the city. And I think we're making good progress on it. And I'm real hopeful for where things are going, and I guess I hope we've been able to address your concerns tonight. And you know, if you need us back again, we can do it, because I really think we have a lot of good solid numbers under there. And it is, you know, I was talking about it with Wade, and it's like, yeah, hell yeah, that's a lot of money. And if you're going to go back and you got a constituent asking you, hey, why is this so expensive, I say, well, you know, here's the reasons. And I hope your staff will tell you that it's like, hey, this is the investment that we think is needed for these facilities, and it's the move the city needs to make to secure the water supply. So, anyway.
All right. Thank you, Jesse.
Thanks for your time. Yep.
And just to wrap up just what these guys have done or doing, yeah, I think our goal in the city is to have a well that's going to let go for the long haul, like well after we're all, you know, off the council and off the staff. And so we're looking for not a Yugo type car. We're looking for, you know, Ford built truck or a Mercedes or something that's going to last for long haul. That costs money. And so I was definitely shocked when I saw the price and looked at numbers and stuff. But as we go through it and look at the cost, you know, it's sort of like the difference between a car engine and an airplane engine. You know, you can go out working a car engine and drive all day. If it breaks down, so what? But an airplane engine will be different. So airplane engine parts cost more. The certified mechanics cost more, everything else costs more. So with a water supply system, it just, as I'm finding out, it costs a lot more. But these guys have done almost worst case scenario as far as cost, and that's what we're looking at. I hope it'll come up under that somehow. But we're going to do what's best for the city. The staff studied this real hard, and I'm pretty certain we're going to get a good product out of it. We've dug a good well. That's the good news. We spent the money to do that. We got a good liner in it. We spent some extra money on a liner. And we're going to continue to do that with these other parts. So thanks to these guys for putting us stuff together.
So I also want to recap. The council approved this project for $2.7 million. And if these estimates come in for this additional 1.1, we would come in at about between 2.8 and 2.9 million, which would be just those estimates were based back in 2011 and 12. Some critical things happened, though, in the process of this. Number one, that I can think of is that John Lawless was elected to city council, who had quite a lot of experience, and when, in well drilling and just in that whole discipline of information, he was looking at we're only drilling 450 feet, and a decision was made contrary to our water consultant, contrary to our engineering firm at the time, that we needed to drill deeper. And we took that advice, subsequently replaced our water consultant and our engineering firm, and tonight I can just see what a great decision that was. They were trying to set us up to spend $5 million to get what we are about to get for under $3 million. And in one well, and not the maintenance and ongoing of two wells. So I want to thank John for bringing that advice to the council, and for Varela and for Aspect Engineering in helping guide us through all of this process that we're now on. And I think, as we've seen over the last couple of months, what happens when your main wells go down, what a hardship it creates on the community, how it makes us scramble. Some of it is good is coming out of it, in that we're understanding we need to have a better emergency plan, a communication plan. I want to say that this all happened, I believe, the way it was supposed to happen. And John being elected to the council and being able to give the rest of us his advice based on his field knowledge was really critical, because until tonight, I don't think any of us could see the wisdom. We just knew we wanted more water than what we were getting at 450 feet. And we actually fought resistance at one point from going further. And I just appreciate now more this process that we've gone through, and I'll leave it to that. Okay? Thank you, Jesse. So now let's move on to item 2.04, and Travis, you have some information on our boundary line adjustments and updating our code.
So I'll try and make this quick because it's getting late. So this is a slide I took from one of my first presentations I made to you about the roles of the Planning Commission and comprehensive planning. And this is just a reminder that there is city code, which basically says it's the city council's responsibility to give assignments to the Planning Commission to pursue, which is what I'm here to do today. And that is, I'd like the opportunity to work with the Planning Commission to go through what I've been calling the retooling our code effort. I've been keeping an ongoing list of issues that come up and that I've identified need to be fixed. And to be honest, I got to a certain point and I just got tired of writing stuff down. And yes, I did add underground infrastructure section to this list, so it will be on there tomorrow. But there are specifically two particular codes that I would like to talk to the Planning Commission about, and they are boundary line adjustments. And the other one is the lot size requirement for major plat. Specifically, our code says anything 5 acres or larger has to go through a major plat as opposed to a short plat, regardless of how many lots they're creating. So if you want me to proceed with going to the Planning Commission to discuss this list and these two items in particular, if I get that assignment today, then I will schedule a Planning Commission hearing to discuss those issues. We'll make recommend, or the Planning Commission will make a recommendation. I will prepare that for you in an agenda memo and ordinance for you to consider, and then I'll bring it back to you in a public hearing for you to make a decision after you've had a chance to take a look at what they recommended. Any questions?
No, I think council deserves consensus to have Travis proceed with this.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Good job.
Yep. Is there any committee reports tonight? Any unfinished business?
I just got a quick comment.
Yeah.
Earlier you were asking him about the,
the pump and stuff like that, can they just put anyone in the well? They, in their, the bid documents or the contracts and stuff like that, the contractor will have to submit submittals, and then the engineer approves or disapproves them or make changes as needed. So that was just a comment I had. So it's not just the contractors going out there and saying, okay, let's get this and this and this. So,
yeah. The specification will be written.
Yes.
What you mean, yeah.
You'll specify AWWA valves, you know, and yeah, all that stuff.
I guess I also forgot to point out in my little summation, a local contractor ran all the transmission lines and sewer lines well under the budget of what was the engineering, the previous engineering firm. And so that's part of, those are a combination of the reasons what have helped bring us to this point where we're really within 10% of our original estimate from three and a half years ago. So when you look at that as in the big picture, I think that's, there's been a lot of good things that have come about as a result of it, and I just appreciate that. Is there any other new business?
Yes.
Yes. Who's first?
Well, I just had a question I was going to ask Terry about well six. And if they got the pump head on tonight, I know that was a...
Yep, they had a 10-foot stick out this morning, the well head and the pump motor, and as of 6:28 this afternoon, they were setting the motor on top of that. So they should have electrical and everything ready to go in the morning to hook up and everything, and we should be able to turn the switch.
So my new business was well six too. It's a 900 horsepower motor. How much, what percentage of that 900 horse do you think we're using?
Well, it's not efficient.
Right.
It's just too big. It's basically, that pump's designed, according to Snyder, 600 horse, a little over 600
right.
horse.
Okay. So part of the reason we're, maybe part of the reason why we're twisting these couplers and stuff is you're starting that 900 horse across the line.
Mm-hmm.
You have no soft start, no VFD in front of that. I think that we should look at that in committee and look at the cost of, I think you could replace that motor with a 600. Now you're running 2400 volt,
mm-hmm.
okay? That helps in a way with electrical power because you're running higher voltage, but we may want to look at it in committee and say, okay, let's give up the voltage. Let's go 480. Let's put a 600 horse on there. Let's put at least a soft start on it so that it actually ramps up instead of turning on and going like that at 900 horse and potentially causing damage. I think we need to look at that in committee. We have water sewer budget. We have... It's something that well is so important to us, and it's such a high yield well that we should invest some money into it to protect it, to help it. And I think staff has got an idea what needs to be done. We just need to support them.
Well, we've taken it out to Vista for the VFD to see if we can get some money to put that in.
For 2400 volt?
Yeah, to take it down. And we know that from all of Chris's calculations that what we've got setting up there shouldn't be doing what we're doing to it. So we've changed those couplers to stainless from mild steel, basically, carbon steel coupler. So anyway, we've gone what you're saying. We've gone that route to get some numbers back. We know that right now we can speculate what that cost is going to be.
Yeah.
But we did, at the last update or a couple of updates ago, I had mentioned that we went down, when you talked about being, if rebuilds were more than new, then we went new. We went as efficient as we could to the bottom. What isn't efficient is at the top.
Yeah.
So we're using what we have now to get started with, but we're still working on the other end of that to get some numbers together to come back to council to change that upper side so that it's 600 or 6 1/4 and it's a soft start or VFD. That's what we're working on to finish that efficiency out.
Great.
We just don't have that dollar, and I couldn't do it all at one time.
But that's something we need to think about for the future with that well in particular, is still need to put more money into it to make it what it should be.
How long has that well been there?
63,
mm-hmm.
probably.
Somewhere in there.
Probably drilled that the same time they drilled the one up at Chef Reddy. Milwaukee Railroad probably did it.
Okay. So,
of course, then that brings up the question, do we want to delay the start? Or do we want to go ahead and pump?
Not if Terry thinks everything's fine. I'm just saying
I think what we need to do is not delay it. Move ahead.
Move ahead.
Let staff deal with the soft starts and electronics and the things like that. When we get that number together, then we'll take it to the committee. We'll let the committee know. Then we'll bring it to council.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea to budget that. I think one of the things that we have seen over the years is that well has cost this city an inordinate amount of money, and some of that is the design, as John is pointing out.
We're not listening to the people that are telling us what we really need to do, and we need to listen to them, to Dan and to Terry, mm-hmm. and get that to happen for them.
We'd love to swing that over, but that's a lot of voltage and a lot of money. So we're trying to put those numbers together and get something so we can get it back to the committee, mm-hmm. and then get it to council, get it in the budget, something. But we've got to get something back from Avista. There's a contact that we have there that's working on that, trying to get some of that money back on a rebate program. So we're waiting to hear back from him, and I touched base with Ian, and I haven't heard anything yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Terry.
Okay.
Any other new business?
Chief, how did we do this weekend? I talked to one of the sergeants and asked him how we did on enforcing the ordinance that was passed, and if we had drafted any citations for...
Thank you. Council, we gave a lot of warnings. We actually had 14 or 15 calls between the 4th and the 5th. I think there's one or two on the 5th. A lot of warnings, no citations issued, and I'd say of those 14 or 15 documented warnings, we probably had two or three times that in just verbals.
Okay. No fires were caused, though, in the city?
None.
Limits from any
other fires. Than a tree at the... No, there was no fire.
Okay.
That we're aware of.
Anything else? Council. All right, with that, we'll adjourn our meeting at 9:12 p.m.